because environments and the states that we talked about have local interactions. So if before we walked into the room, the chairs really were, and the chair being here and the chair being there, and all the air molecules were in some initial state, then just very, very quickly, this is going to go to 1 over root 2 here, and then all the air molecules correlated with here, plus the other way around. And so once again, it's the overlap between the air molecules bouncing off the chair there and bouncing off the chair there, which is exponentially small. Exponentially small in the number of air molecules in the room. And so that's why such a quantum state is incredibly fragile, okay? And in a minuscule, minuscule time is going to be decoherent. Yes?
There's something else there that's doing the same thing as the air
molecules. Well, no, so that's why genuinely quantum things can survive in situations where they're hardly disturbed. Then you can actually have interesting quantum fluctuations. That's why the superfluid works. It's cold. You make it very, very cold. And then, again, you have to remove as much as possible influence and interaction with the environment. That's why when you do, you know, that's why it's very, very hard for people to do double slit experiments with large collections of matter. They're very, very proud of themselves. They could do double slit experiments with buckyballs. But then you have to make sure it's incredibly, incredibly well isolated from the environment. That's why making a quantum computer is hard, because you have to you want to have these very entangled states to do computation, but interaction with the environment is going to decohere it. Quantum coherence is an incredibly fragile thing, and the reason is that the timescale for decoherence is not set at all by the typical timescale for energy exchange or to lose half your energy, nothing, right? It's exponentially fast. It is exponentially fast because all you have to do is change everything in the environment by one part in 100,000, and if there's 10 to the 30 things in the environment, you're screwed. Okay? The coherence goes down exponentially. But I more specifically want to say the reason why it's position eigenstate. You say, what is it that makes the basis special? What makes the basis special is the nature of interactions. The nature of interactions is local. Okay? Interactions take place in position space, and that's why it's the, as I said before, the important point is that given some interaction, there are some special states. There are some special states of the environment which do roughly evolve in this factorized form. The chair sitting there and the air molecules in the room, as they evolve that state, a little while longer, the chair is more or less still sitting there. And the air molecules have moved off somewhere else. They've bounced off of it and moved off somewhere else. Okay? So that state, just the state of the chair localized there, is a special state. It's picked out. It's singled out by the nature of the interaction, the fact that there's local interactions between the air molecules and the chair. However, the linear superposition of chair there and there is not such a special state. Okay? If it starts unentangled, it will quickly become entangled. So there are special states, and this depends on the nature of the interaction. But depending on the nature of the interaction, the system and the environment, there are special states that do not entangle easily with the environment. And most states will, and linear superpositions of those system states will entangle horrendously with the environment. And so you'll constantly find, so it's quantum mechanics that tells you what looks classical, as it should be. That's, you know, it's the correct theory, right? But it tells you what should be classical in this more, in this interesting way. Yes?
But the way it is sometimes described by people as saying that the Broglie wavelength of something like the chair would be too small.
Now, all of that is also true. All of that is also true. But you see, that's it's really two statements. The usual statement that big things are classical is really the statement that there exists some quantum states in the theory that behave approximately classically. And that's certainly true, and it's true that there's de Broglie, you know, all that is true, okay? However, there's still the question why we don't observe strange quantum superpositions of such states, okay? So two things are necessary for a classical limit to emerge. One, there have to be some states that are classical-like, okay? And two, and you have to understand why it is that that's more or less all you see, and you don't see crazy superpositions of them. Okay? And it says, and the statement about the de Broglie wavelength and so on is just that if you make a Gaussian wave packet for the chair with this big mass, that its spreading time is infinitely large, it more or less moves around following the center of the wave packet, follows Newton's laws and everything. Okay? So that's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient. You then have to understand why it is that you don't see 1 over root 2 there plus there, and the reason for that is decoherence.
Even if this were not interacting with the environment?
Yes.
Yes. Would you be able to see superposition at all?
But sure. You could put it in, it depends on the nature of experiment that you do. But
in vacuum, if you have macroscopic objects like chairs and stuff, you don't see superposition.
As I said, you can have a macroscopic object which is a big vat of superfluid helium. Okay? That's a very quantum object. Macroscopic doesn't have anything to do with it. Yes.
Basically, using the terminology, see something in a superposition. And I think this is confusing me because to see something, you need a whole bunch of photons.
Let me be more precise.
Yeah.
I mean, is there any experiment whose outcome is consistent with putting the initial state of the chair to be 1 over root 2 here plus 1 over root 2 there? Okay. You would get very different answers for that than if the chair was just definitely here. There's lots of experiments that you could do where you get very different answers. Now, see literally, of course, because of what we just talked about. I'm using see in the first sense, in a technical sense. I really should mean, are there states, the state at a given time, are they well described by strange linear superpositions of these guys? Of course, I agree with you, because of the reasons that we just said. When you ultimately see something, because we're big and macroscopic, we'll never see it in the superposition. We'll see it because of this, literally the photons entering our eye, correlating our brain with seeing that. We don't see it in that sense in the superposition. So I should be more precise, and thanks. But what I literally mean when I was saying see was why such funny states aren't ubiquitous in nature around us.
Okay. Yeah. We could see a chair in a superposition. What you mean is, if we had a super high vacuum, we could do, for example, a double slit experiment.
Yes. That is exactly what I mean. That is precisely what I mean. So, yes, exactly. We could do a double slit experiment. And on the other side, on the screen, when the chairs are seen, okay, then you see them here. You see a chair here, you see a chair there, and that second C is because of what we just talked about. We are macroscopic, we correlate with the chair, and so on. But I really mean, do you see a diffraction pattern of chair, okay? And the reason we don't see diffraction patterns of chair if we put screens in front of chairs is because the chair has been happily interacting with the air molecules in the room, okay? And so that's why we don't, that's why any such superposition of them is just totally destroyed. That is why it's very hard to do, you know, if you fire bowling balls at a double slit, you don't see diffraction. And you would, again, we're saying exactly the same thing. You would if it was in a super, super vacuum, no interaction with anything, then you could. Then you absolutely could. All right. So, so the general notion of entanglement that we've been talking about is if I have some system A and another system B, and if I talk about a wave function, a state which is some inner product of something in A and B, then we say that this is unentangled. But if psi is some linear combination of some parameters in general, then this is entangled. Now, just as we did before, Now, beforehand, one system, B, was much bigger than A in all of our discussions. More generally, you can just say there's an A and a B. And it's useful to talk about a reduced density matrix for just the system A, which is what you get by tracing over system B, and vice versa. Now, you can ask if someone hands you such, so if you're doing measurements on some, so let's say you know you have a system A and a system B, but you're just doing measurements on A. Is there anything, any measurement you can make on A that will tell you that it's entangled with B? Let's say you believe that the whole state is pure, okay? Are there measurements that you could do that will convince you that it's entangled with B? Yes. Yes, you can certainly do measurements that would convince you that it's entangled with B. For example, you could check to see whether the density matrix rho A corresponds to a pure state. There's various checks you can do if a density matrix corresponds to a pure state, like if rho squared is equal to rho, or other things that you could do. But there's actually a very nice notion, which I just want to quickly tell you about, which is called entanglement entropy. So given any old density matrix, the entanglement entropy, well, the entropy associated with density matrix is just defined to be negative trace rho log rho. Just like in StatMac, this is just a sum of negative probability. This is sum of probability log probability. There's a minus sign because the probabilities are less than 1. Okay. Now, what's nice about the entanglement entropy, well, something that you can see, actually, this is a nice exercise for you to prove, is that the entanglement entropy associated, this entropy associated with the with rho A is actually equal to that associated with B. Okay. So if they're in a big pure state, the entropy associated with the subsystem A is equal to the entropy associated with subsystem B. And because of this, we can refer to it as the entanglement entropy between them. And something which is also nice and pretty easy to prove, and a very simple consequence of the convexity or concavity, some simple property of the function x log x, is that the entanglement entropy is actually less than or equal to the log of the entanglement entropy for A or for B, whichever one, is less than or equal to the log of, well, because they're equal, it's less than or equal to the log of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. So in fact, this S, let me just back up, this S is defined is always less than or equal to the dimensionality, the log of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. And you get that value in the case where PI, if it's an n by n state, this upper limit is reached when PI is just 1 over n, 1 over n, 1 over n, 1 over n, a diagonal matrix proportional to the identity in 1 over n. So that's what you'd call a maximally mixed state. With that maximally mixed state, you just get log n. Okay? And in fact, the fact that the function x log x is concave allows you to prove that that's what maximizes. Anyway, I mention this because you could, in principle, by doing all the measurements you want on either A or B, determine the density matrix for A or B. Okay. And then it's just kind of cool because you can learn something. So let's say you're a gigantic system, but you suspect you might be entangled with a smaller system. Then if you know that you started with a big pure state, this is a way that you can learn about the maximum size of the Hilbert space of the smaller system. Okay, you just look at how, you just look at your reduced density matrix, and you see what the entropy is that you would measure from minus, you would compute from minus trace your rho log rho, and that puts an upper bound on the logarithm of the dimension of the Hilbert space of what's inside the other system. Yes?
You could do this in practice. So, like, to know anything about the density matrix, you'd have to do, like, something like quantum state tomography.
Sorry?
To actually, if you wanted to do this in practice,
yes.
You don't have access directly to the density matrix, so you have to do some sort of quantum state tomography. Yes.
No, I mean, you just do infinitely many measurements and you reconstruct the density matrix from
it. Right.
Yes.
So,
I'm not sure. You have to do an infinite number of measurements for this quantum mechanics. So, you're doing an infinite number of times that you want.
It sort of doesn't occur to me, like if you have one electron, if you have, you know, an EPR experiment, right, you want to figure out whether there's entanglement, you have to, you want to do this, right, by finding the density matrix, like you have two measurements on it,
mm-hmm.
find the density matrix, then you can calculate the entanglement. But once you, like, you do one measurement, and then...
Well, you can't do it with one system. So again, you have to have an infinity available to you, right? You have to do it infinitely many times, but if you have the results
of
every possible...
Oh, so not many times, but then you have to have a couple of identical systems.
Yes, yes, and you have to do many different kinds of measurements and measure many different operators and do as much as you possibly can, okay? But measuring every possible thing you possibly can, you can reconstruct your density matrix. Yes, absolutely. All right, so anyway, so we just saw that... that the process of measurement entangles things, interaction with the environment entangles things. The quantum classical limit involves entangling big things with big environments with little subsystems. And now I want to tell you about an incredibly basic thing, which has a lot of entanglement in it, and which starts being the begins a lot of very, very, which is associated with a lot of very beautiful physics and ultimately some of the very deep questions about cosmology that I was starting to tell you about. The system is the vacuum. The vacuum has an enormous amount of entanglement, has lots of entanglement. Quantum vacuum. Oh, sorry. Before I proceed, I should have said one other obvious thing about two systems. There's another way that you can check, if you actually have access to both measurements, both A and B measurements, there's another very simple way that you can decide whether you're entangled or not, which is to look at what you might want to call a correlation function. So let's say that you have some operator made out of A and some other operator made out of B. Okay, and you have the state psi. So something that you might be interested in is what is the expectation value of OA O prime B? Okay? Well, if this is not entangled, this is just equal to the product of the expectation value of the two expectation values. Okay. So actually, let me not label these by A and B. Let me label them by just two totally generic states. Okay. Okay. So if it's entangled, it looks like this, right? So then, if I look at the expectation value of OO prime minus the product of the expectation values of O and O prime. Sorry. Then if it's unentangled, then this is zero. So the extent to which this object is not equal to zero is another measure of a correlation. That's why it's called the correlation function, right? It tells you, if you see something here, is there something there, right? It's a measure of how entangled A and B are with each other. Okay. So in order to show you what I mean by the vacuum being entangled, let's imagine we have a very, the vacuum in quantum field theory is highly entangled. Okay? In order to do this, let me remind you again that let's say you have any old kind of field. So let's say just a massless scalar field. And we've talked about this many times, but we can think about this massless scalar field as being associated with the Hamiltonian, which is a different harmonic oscillator for all the particle in the box modes, right? So it's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. And in momentum space, I would let me call each momentum mode, let me label it by K. Then the Hamiltonian is literally just think about phi k like x in normal harmonic oscillators. So the Hamiltonian is literally p squared plus x, is really p squared plus omega squared x squared. Okay? And what is the omega? The omega k, the analog of omega, is just the frequency associated with k, which if the particle is massless, is just the magnitude of k. So now I'm going to write something down which typically people don't write down in a lot of field theory texts. And that's, again, because very often, and especially in particle physics-oriented textbooks, people are very quickly getting on to talking about Feynman diagrams and scattering and things like that. But you should remember, quantum field theory is just another quantum mechanics system. Happens to be a quantum mechanics system with infinitely many degrees of freedom. But you can write down a wave function for it, just like you can for anything else. Okay? So let's write down the wave function of the vacuum in quantum field theory. Okay? To do that, let's just remind ourselves, what is the wave function of a harmonic oscillator in the x representation? The wave function is e to the minus omega x squared. Right? So now all I have in field theory, then, I have the wave function. Now, instead of x, I'm going to have an infinite number of phi k's, right? Instead of x, I'm going to have an infinite number of phi k's. So I should have a product over all these k's of a separate e to the minus omega x squared for each one of them. It's just a harmonic oscillator for each one of these guys. So this would be, roughly speaking, this is a loose, and then I'll write down a more precise. The product over k of e to the minus omega k, which is the magnitude of k, times phi k squared. And this product over k I can put as an e to the negative sum over k. But sum over k, since k is continuous, really means e to the negative the integral of k, right? So psi of phi is e to the minus the integral d cubed k, magnitude of k, phi k squared. It's a nice Gaussian wave function. Okay. The variables are phi sub k. So if I give you some field configuration phi, I can give you some field configuration phi of x, let's say, in the x representation. You can Fourier transform it to the k representation, and that's the amplitude that the vacuum will be found in that state. It's just the vacuum wave function. In fact, I could write it in x space if I wanted. I won't write it explicitly, but this is some d cubed x, d cubed y, phi in the x representation, some function of x minus y, let me call call it delta of x minus y times some function of the y, some function of y. Now, in particular, so let's say I look at the expectation value of phi at any point x. That should be 0, right? There's a complete symmetry between phi and negative phi. So this expectation value should be 0. But what is the expectation value of phi? Remember, these are just Schrodinger operators, right? Phi at x and phi of y at two different points is equal to what? Well, in principle, you know the wave function. So you just shove in the wave function, do the integral, right? I mean, literally, this is just sandwiching. But we actually don't have to do any of this because the answer is completely determined by dimensional analysis. To do that, let's figure out what are the units of phi? What are the units of phi? Well, let's go back up here. What are the units of phi in momentum space? This entire integral, whatever it is, should be dimensionless, right? So phi should have units of mass to the minus 2 in momentum space. Minus 2, that could be minus 4, which exactly eats up the plus 4 that I have here. So phi k in momentum space is units of mass squared. Mass to the minus 2, sorry. So to get phi of x is d cubed k, phi k, e to the I kx. So this is mass cubed times 1 over mass squared. This has units of mass. Okay. So phi has units of mass. That's actually pretty cool. Even before we compute this correlation function, I want to tell you this because this is one of the very huge central differences between field theory and quantum mechanics. You see, you might think of phi of x and t, okay, and you might think of this as like a free. You might think of this x as a label. And then, so this is just like some function of t. So you might think this is just like quantum mechanics with like a separate free particle at every point x, a continuum of free particles at every point x. Okay. But let's say I wanted to write down the Lagrangian for this guy. Okay. The Lagrangian, or the whole action, just because of relativity, would have to have the form of some ddt phi squared minus ddx phi squared. It has to be Lorentz invariant. So you would write it as an integral d4x d mu phi d mu phi. It can't just have a piece that looks like velocity squared. It also has a gradient piece, okay, a spatial gradient piece. Grad phi squared. Okay? So it is not exactly like, if there was no grad phi squared piece, it would be exactly like a separate, ordinary, non-relativistic particle at every point in space. Okay? Now, what does an ordinary non-relativistic particle do? The x position, the x operator, is, I mean, the ground state, for example, is totally delocalized in x. You put in a big box, it spreads out as much as possible in the size of the box, right? So there's enormous fluctuations in the position operator for a free particle. But these gradients are suppressing those fluctuations, because you can't fluctuate here without forcing it to fluctuate nearby, because you pay a lot of gradient energy. And so something actually quite wonderful happens when you go above two spatial dimensions. Okay, starting in three spatial dimensions, sorry, really above one spatial dimension, at two spatial dimensions and above, the fluctuations in phi become small at very long distances. so that you can talk about such a thing as the average value of phi averaged out over a huge distance. In fact, let's say instead, if I were to look at, let me just look at, oh, by the way, from here too, you can immediately see that phi should have mass dimension 1, because this action should also be dimensionless. So there's d4x, that's mass dimension minus 4. The derivatives have mass dimension plus 1. So the phis have to have mass dimension plus 1 for this to work out. Okay. All right, well, but so let's just see it. So whatever it is, this correlation function has to have units of mass squared. So what can it be? Just 1 over x minus y squared. So because the expectation value of phi at any point is 0, but phi of x, phi of y has a non-zero correlation function with no scale in it, I mean, it gets small as you go to long distances. That means that it is possible to know the value of phi averaged out over all space. That's a well-defined observable, quantum mechanically. That's a beautiful fact. Okay? It's possible to talk about the average value of phi over an enormous distance. Okay? But more than that, it tells you that you cannot think in quantum field theory of the vacuum as being an independent state here, tensored with an independent state here, tensored with an independent state here. That in the position basis, the vacuum is highly entangled. The vacuum here is entangled to the vacuum there, is entangled to the vacuum there, and so on. Is that clear? And you see that because of this non-zero value of the correlation function. It's also obvious, roughly speaking, the wave function is local in momentum space. Okay. In momentum space, it's something totally independent of different momenta, but then it can't be that in position space. Right. This has a remarkable consequence. It has a remarkable consequence that if, for some reason or another, even though the whole system might even be Minkowski space or close to it, but if for any old reason, you have only access to part of the space, then any physics that you're going to do will not see a pure state, even though the entire state is pure. It's just a vacuum. It couldn't be more boring, right? But remarkably, if for any reason at all, you're restricting yourself or you're stuck to only doing measurements that involve observables in some region of space and not another region of space, then your reduced density matrix is inevitably mixed. Okay? Now, of course, you could say that that's your willful ignorance, right? You're deciding to only look here, and that's true. But there are situations where the geometry is curved, so that, as in the case of a black hole, there are really regions of space that you cannot access and come back out of. So if you decide to stay outside a black hole, even though the entire state is a pure state, is the vacuum solution, including the black hole, then what you see on the outside is not surprising. It's not surprising given that there's entanglement in the vacuum. Even in Minkowski space, what you see from the outside will be thermal. That's why horizons are associated with thermal behavior. Okay? That thermality, now I haven't told you why it's thermal quite yet. The general argument tells you that it's just some mixed state. Okay? I haven't quite told you why it's thermal yet. But in order to do that, let's look at the simplest example of a horizon possible. As it turns out, every single horizon, including the black hole horizon, sufficiently close to the horizon looks like what I'm about to tell you. Okay, so this example is incredibly universal. And it's just a property of Minkowski space. So horizons and entanglement in Minkowski space. So I'm just going to talk about 1 plus 1 dimensions. So this is really Rindler space. Okay. I want to just talk about 1 plus 1 dimensions. So here's time, and here's space. All right? And now what I want to do is imagine cutting space into two pieces, two halves, the piece to the left here and the piece to the right. All right? And what I want to imagine is a special kind of observer that will never, ever be able to receive any information from anything sent from the left. Okay? I want to do that because I just want to find some set of observers for whom, naturally, they're stuck with only getting information from part of the space. Okay? Well, whoever these observers are, I want them to be like normal, made out of normal particles. But whoever they are, they clearly have to asymptotically be traveling at the speed of light up here, right? Otherwise, something close enough here would still, I could still get them some information, right? So let me draw the light cone here. And let's say that here's the observer. Here's what the world line of the observer would be if they were just sitting around. And whether they liked it or not, you know, some information from this side would get to them, right? So that's not what I want to do. I want to look at some set of observers that just because of what they're doing, they will never get any information from L. So what should this guy do? It should start accelerating. Right? Start accelerating and moving away. All right? So, well, it's relativity, right? So if he's going to accelerate and move away, eventually it's going to asymptote to that. Eventually it's going to asymptote to that line, right? Now, I can imagine a time symmetrical situation here, where this guy was also screaming in with a huge velocity, right, and accelerating in the opposite direction, stop. So this guy's coming in, stopping, and then accelerating in the opposite direction. Okay. All right. So here's one observer like that. Now, let's work out what is the, so that the simplest thing you could possibly imagine is that the observer has constant acceleration, right? So what could we mean by that? Well, let me try to give the world line for these observers as a function of the elapsed proper time on that trajectory. Let's just first do it a little bit intuitively. So if this was non-relativistic, I would say that x is equal to, around here, is equal to, let's say this distance is rho, okay, or r, x naught, okay? I'd say x is x naught plus a half a t squared, right? And t would be the proper time. I mean, when it's non-relativistic, there's no difference between t and the proper time. Okay. So t is t naught. Okay. On the other hand, there's something very natural that this could be relativistically. I mean, what is the nicest shape this could possibly be? It's a hyperbola, right? So the nicest thing I could possibly have that matches this would be to say that X is equal to some rho cosh tau, and T is rho sinh tau. And we can now match rho and tau to these guys. So if I expand this out, this would be rho plus a half rho tau squared, right? Plus dot, dot, dot. Meanwhile, the time t would be rho tau. So from here, we can identify what the acceleration is, right? So for this trajectory, I can map, for this trajectory, I can map rho is equal to 1 over a. And it also tells me for this particular case, it's telling me which I'm also choosing x naught properly so that this thing asymptotes to a like cone coming from the origin. Okay. So this is the nice relativistic way of talking about the world line of a particle that's uniformly accelerating. And the acceleration is given by 1 over a. And by not adding a constant, I've chosen the constant so that this is asymptoting to a light ray coming out of the origin. Okay. In fact, every time you have a situation like this, every time you have boosts, period, it's very useful to use different variables other than x and t. It's useful to define the variables, well, let me call them y plus or minus, which are just x plus or minus t. Right? Because in terms of these variables, if the metric is dt squared minus dx squared, in terms of these variables, this is also 2 dy plus dy minus. And so the action of Lorentz transformations is much easier on y plus minus than it is on x and t. On y plus minus, it's just y plus goes to you know, any constant, z times y plus, and y minus goes to z inverse times y minus. Lorentz transformations just multiply y plus by something and y minus by the opposite thing. And in terms of these y plus minus coordinates, what we're doing is just defining y plus the uniform acceleration is just y plus minus is rho e to the plus minus tau. So Lorentz transformations act particularly easily. Lorentz transformations just shift tau. They're just tau goes to tau plus constant. Right? So in these coordinates, Lorentz transformations are the easiest possible thing. So there's one uniformly accelerating trajectory with the acceleration, if that's rho with acceleration 1 over rho, here's another one. So there's a whole family of these guys, which are all uniformly accelerating with different accelerations, right? And also different starting points in such a way that they all asymptote to exactly the same like cone. So this is a nice, interesting set of coordinates to choose for this quarter region of Minkowski space. Okay? In this quarter region of Minkowski space, this is a very nice set of coordinates. In other words, instead of using x and t, let me use the coordinates y plus and y minus, and then actually from there switch the coordinates rho and tau. Right? So a given rho tells you the intercept on the x-axis, and a given tau just tells you, in fact, what you can do to get a given tau is to start from some any point here and just boost by an amount tau. Because Lorentz transformations are just translations in tau. Okay? So these are called Rindler coordinates. And so they're coordinates for describing this part of Minkowski space. So rho and tau are Rindler coordinates. This slice of Minkowski space, this quarter piece, is called Rindler space. And by the way, these coordinates are, the Euclidean analog of these coordinates are very familiar to you. What is the Euclidean analog of this? It's just polar coordinates. Right? These are precisely polar coordinates. If you think about it, if tau was imaginary, this would just be, this would have been x is r cos theta, y is r sine theta. Instead, it was x is rho cosh tau, and t is rho sinh tau. Okay, so it's cosh's and sinh's rather than cosines and sines. And just like with rotations, working with polar coordinates makes the action of rotations trivial because it just shifts the angle by a constant. So working in Rindler coordinates makes the action of Lorentz transformations trivial. It shifts the value of tau. But because the structure of Minkowski spacetime isn't identical to Euclidean space, these coordinates aren't covering all of Minkowski space. They're covering this region of it. Okay. Actually, I could also use them to cover this other region if I allowed rho to be negative as well. Okay. So if I allow rho to be negative, both positive and negative, then I can cover both the left and the right part of Minkowski space. Now, let's just write what the metric is in this space. The metric in this space is, well, you won't be surprised from the analog with rotations. It's just this. This is the analog of dr squared plus r squared d theta squared. Because r is like rho and theta is like tau. If that's too quick for you, let's just go back to this formula. Remember, up to twos, the metric here is dy plus dy minus. Well, dy plus is just d rho plus rho d tau, e to the tau. Dy minus is d rho minus rho d tau, e to the minus tau. So the product, dy plus dy minus, is exactly what I said. Just rho squared d tau squared minus d rho squared. So this is the metric in Rindler space. It's flat space. I've just written flat space and some other coordinates, okay, and some natural analog of polar coordinates. But you'll notice something interesting happens here. The coefficient of, so tau looks like a time. Tau looks like a time variable. And this, nothing is explicitly dependent on tau. So there's tau translational invariance, right? These coordinates, there's tau translational invariance. What is it that's giving you tau translations? Tau translations are given by the Lorentz boost, okay? So to these observers, they're Hamiltonian. What is the Hamiltonian? The Hamiltonian is what gives you time translations for whatever your time is, right? What is the time for these guys? The time for these guys is actually a Lorentz boost, okay? Which is also a symmetry of the problem. It's also a symmetry of the theory, okay? So these guys is Hamiltonian. What these observers measure is energy, okay? What their detectors respond to, everything. What they see, what they think of as a Hamiltonian is what us observers living in the inertial frame say, no, that's not our Hamiltonian. Our Hamiltonian is the thing that takes us from this spatial slice to the next spatial slice to the next spatial slice. That's our Hamiltonian. Your Hamiltonian is what we call a Lorentz boost. Okay? So the Hamiltonian for the Rindler guy is not our Hamiltonian, is not the inertial Hamiltonian, but is instead the Lorentz boost. Okay? All right. Now, notice something interesting about this metric. As you head in towards rho equals 0, the coefficient of d tau squared goes to 0. Okay? That's one of the classic signs of the presence of a horizon. If you've ever looked at the black hole metric, the place where there's a horizon is where the coefficient of the dt squared in the Schwarzschild metric goes to 0. Okay? That's because as you're heading in towards 0, there is an enormous redshift. Okay? So let's see if we can understand that redshift physically here. Going back to this picture. So what do I really mean? I really mean, so rho equals 0 is a horizon. So let me just write that down. And OK, we can see that, right? Because again, anything to the left here, any signal that they send will never reach these observers. Right? And so this is the place rho equals 0. That this line in the underlying Minkowski space is a place rho equals 0. Okay. Now, so let's ask a question. Let's take two observers. One of them is just merrily sitting at rest and falling through the horizon. Of course, this is just Minkowski space, so there's no fancy thing happening. But by falling through the horizon, I mean falling through the Rindler horizon, which means, you know, they're just sitting there. Okay? They're just sitting there doing nothing. So that's observer, lazy observer A. Observer B is one of the Rindler, is one of these uniformly accelerating observers, which means that in Rindler coordinates, this observer is sitting at a constant value of rho. Okay, they're sitting at a constant value of rho, and they're uniformly accelerating. So here's observer B. Okay. Now, observer A sees that at 2 o'clock, they were on their clock. They were in front of the Rindler horizon. And at 3 o'clock, they were behind the Rindler horizon. Okay. But observer B never sees observer A cross the Rindler horizon. Right? Again, that's exactly like a black hole. All these things that you've heard about a black hole are just exactly what's happening here. There's a good reason for this, as I'll show you in a second. That every horizon, with one exception, every horizon looks like this close enough. The near horizon region of almost all horizons looks like Rindler space. Okay? So, but you see what's going on, right? This guy will send a signal at 2, I'm still OK. And at 3, no signal will ever get to B. Okay. So what B sees instead, at least classically, is that A keeps sending these signals and just keeps getting signals. Of course, the signals will say, it's 2, it's 201, it's 201 in a bit, it's 201 in a little bit, 201 and even a little bit. You'll just never see him cross the horizon. So that's the redshift. That's the enormous redshift as observer B never sees observer A fall through the horizon, even though nothing is happening to observer A. And I remind you, nothing special is happening here at all. There's no black holes or singularities or nothing. This is just Minkowski space. Okay. However, this horizon, as far as observer B is concerned, is in almost every way just like the mysterious black hole horizons that we talked about, right? Classically, guys that you send through there, you know, get more and more redshifted. You never see them fall through. You don't ever see signals from regions behind there, and so on. Okay. Now, let me quickly tell you why it is that black holes look like this. So this is a quick aside. But if people remember, the black hole metric looks something like 1 minus the Schwarzschild radius over r dt squared, and then there's a piece that looks like dr squared over 1 minus r Schwarzschild over r. And then there's an r squared d omega squared. But as r approaches the Schwarzschild radius, the coefficient of dt squared is going to 0. So let me just write r is equal to r Schwarzschild plus delta. Okay. If I do that, then the point is that in this neighborhood, ds squared is going like negative delta dt squared plus, and then this is looking like d delta squared over delta, ignoring factors of r Schwarzschild. And then you can simply redefine delta is equal to rho squared if you're approaching the horizon from the outside. You define delta is equal to rho squared, and then you see d delta squared over delta just as precisely d rho squared, and so the metric becomes ds squared is negative rho squared dt squared plus d rho squared, which is exactly Rindler space. This makes perfect sense, okay? Because after all, a big black hole, the curvatures are very low, you know, in the neighborhood of the horizon. Physics is flat space, so of course there should be some way of writing it that's approximately a flat space metric. What do these observers correspond to physically? See, we're talking about Schwarzschild observers here at fixed radius. Well, what are Schwarzschild observers at fixed radius doing? They're accelerating away from the black hole in order to avoid falling in. If they were just freely falling, they would pass through the horizon. They're like these guys. So the freely falling observers are like these guys. The Schwarzschild observers are constantly accelerating away from the horizon in order to avoid falling in. Okay. And so that's why near enough to any black horizon, the metric is always looks like Rindler space. The physics right in the neighborhood of the horizon is always Rindler space. The one exception is if the black hole has a charge. Charged black holes, typically, the metric looks exactly like this, except for the special case where they're known as extremal black holes, where they have the maximum charge possible compatible with the mass. And then the coefficient of this dt squared turns into a perfect square. When it turns into a perfect square, the metric doesn't look like this. When it turns into a perfect square, the metric close to the horizon actually looks like, automatically, negative delta squared dt squared plus d delta squared over delta squared. And we can write delta is equal to 1 over something else, 1 over rho. This then looks like 1 over rho squared times minus dt squared plus d rho squared in that case. Okay. And this is actually the metric of an anti-de Sitter space. So this is the reason why anti-de Sitter spaces are so ubiquitous. They correspond to what happens when you have black objects with extremal charge equal to the mass in appropriate units. the near horizon region of such an object always looks like anti de Sitter space. But anything else which is not exactly extremal, the near horizon region looks like Rindler space. Anyway, you will definitely talk about these things later, but I just wanted to give you a quick flavor for why it was that all of these things looked a lot like the properties of black hole horizons, because close to the black hole, close to the horizon, it is the same as the black hole horizon. Okay? Rather, the black hole horizon is the same as this. Okay, so that's everything that you can say about the system classically. Well, you can say a lot more, but you can play with it a lot more. But now comes an interesting question. Let's say that what the entire, this is just Minkowski space, and let's say the state, the quantum state is the vacuum, is the Minkowski vacuum. Okay. The question is, what does this observer see? What does the Rindler observer see? Yes, the answer is that the Rindler observer sees the thermal state. But let me now be very specific about what that is. So first of all, it's no surprise that the Rindler observer should see some kind, it's no surprise that the Rindler observer should see some kind of mixed state, right? It can't be a pure state. Because the Rindler observer is only making measurements over here, and there's a non-zero correlation function between the field here and the field there, say. So clearly, it's not something that's unentangled, right? So the quantum vacuum is entangled between the physics that the Rindler observer can see in front of the horizon and the physics that the Rindler observer can't see behind the horizon. The quantum state, the vacuum, is entangled. But so let's there's something very nice, which is that the Rindler Hamiltonian is nothing other than boosts. So we know something. We know that the whole big quantum state, whatever it is, which is entangled between the left and the right, we know that the whole big quantum state is annihilated by the Rindler Hamiltonian. Okay. So let's think about this a little more carefully. So let's say I have the actual Lorentzian boost. Okay? The actual Lorentzian boost would move things along here in this direction on the right, but also moves things in the opposite direction along the left. Okay? So I can talk about a Hamiltonian just on the right, the Rindler Hamiltonian on the right, which is the Rindler Hamiltonian on the right is boosting in this direction. And the Rindler Hamiltonian on the left will be boosting in the opposite direction. Right? But I can talk about eigenstates of this Hamiltonian on the right and eigenstates of the Hamiltonian on the left. The total boost is h left plus h right. Because the actual Lorentzian boost does both. It boosts one way and one the other, right? So this acting on J, acting on the vacuum, is actually equal to zero. Okay? But that means that no matter what's going on, the states here are entangled with states here. But they have to be entangled with a state which has exactly the opposite energy. Okay? So I can make an ansatz for what the state is. I can say that the vacuum, just knowing this and nothing else, the vacuum is a sum over n of some function of En, on the left, let's say, the state En left and E negative En on the right. Yes?
What this means is that, despite the fact that you've got a state on one side of the horizon entangled with a state on the other side of the horizon,
yes,
you can't actually extract any information from any new information from the other side of the horizon anyway.
Well, you could say that the fact that this is perfectly, and ends up to be perfectly thermal is a way of saying that. But we know precisely how they're entangled with each other. There's a constraint on how they're entangled with each other. A given state of a given energy here has to be entangled with a state of opposite energy on the other side. Okay? So that tells you, without doing anything, that if we now look at the reduced density matrix on the right, let's say, that whatever it is just a function of the Rindler-Hamiltonian and nothing else. Okay? In other words, it's just a function. After all, so the reduced density matrix would be rho on the right would be like sum of f squared, you know, en on the left. Okay. I could have also said this right away just by saying that since the Rindler-Hamiltonian in the Rindler space coincides with the boosts, and since the boosts annihilate the vacuum, the density matrix has to commute with the boosts. And therefore, it's a function of the boosts, which is a function of the Hamiltonian, okay, of the Rindler-Hamiltonian. But this is an even more explicit way of saying it, so that there is entanglement, but it's a very specific kind of entanglement between energy states on the left and on the right. Now, one additional argument, which I'll see if I can try to simplify. But one additional argument actually even tells you what that is, more specifically. It's e to the negative 2 pi times the Rindler-Hamiltonian. So you might be confused because you might think the Hamiltonian has units of energy. Actually, remember, this Hamiltonian is a thing that generates tau translations. Tau is dimensionless. Okay? So this Hamiltonian is dimensionless as well. Okay? But it says it's e to the negative 2 pi. So in order to convert an actual Rindler observer here, a little local Rindler observer right around here would have there's a minus rho squared d tau squared plus d rho squared. So if I'm not departing too far away from some rho naught, I can just think of this as minus rho naught tau, d rho naught tau squared, right, plus d rho squared. So I use rho naught to make up the units. Rho naught times tau is the actual time. But what this says is that the Rindler observer measures a temperature. They see a density matrix that corresponds to a temperature 2 pi. Or if they were going to translate it to their own local units, they would say that this local Rindler observer sees a temperature equal to 2 pi over rho naught, which is 2 pi times their acceleration. So this is what's famously known as unrho radiation. And the statement is that uniformly accelerating detectors measure heat. Uniformly accelerating detectors don't see a vacuum. If it's a Minkowski vacuum, a uniformly accelerating detector will register heat. It'll register particles in a thermal spectrum. Okay? But really, it takes a little bit of extra work to get that e to the negative 2 pi, but we can actually say a lot without even being very specific about where this came from. Okay? So first of all, isn't this in wild contradiction? It's not in wild contradiction to anything, of course. This detector, if I think about it in terms of it's really saying, I take this observer, I hand them a detector, they uniformly accelerate, you know, the detector gets hot. Okay? Now, how does that happen? From the point of view of the Minkowski observer, this is totally reasonable, because this guy isn't time translationally invariant. Keeps accelerating more and more and more, there's some agent from the outside giving it more and more and more of a push. It has its couplings to everything aren't time translationally invariant. There's no reason energy should be conserved. Minkowski energy, the energy that is associated with these time translations, there's no reason that should be conserved for that detector, because it's just not being, there's an external agent which is pushing it. So it's not in contradiction with anything. But there's also a sort of lovely intuitive picture. But really, I want to stress in every physical sense, there is temperature for this stuff. Okay. So let's talk about some different senses. By the way, just one quick thing. You see, what's actually important here isn't so much that it's accelerating. It is accelerating, okay? But what's important is that this motion has caused the horizon for this observer. This motion has made it impossible for this observer to get information from some part of space. And that's what makes it effectively thermal. So for instance, if you take whirl a piece of rock or a detector and whirl it around your head, it's also uniformly accelerating. But it only has a uniform magnitude of acceleration, not a uniform direction of acceleration. There's nowhere clearly is it approaching the speed of light or doing anything like that. There's no horizon associated with this guy, and there's absolutely no thermal anything registered by this detector. Okay, so it isn't simply merely acceleration that causes thermality. It's the horizon that causes thermality. Okay, it just so happens that uniform acceleration in one direction is a natural way to force that. That there are horizons for that entire class of observers. Okay. So a Rindler observer sees the horizon, rho equals zero, as an infinitely hot place. Right? A Rindler observer that's sitting here at a nice big rho would take what Lenny Susskind likes to call a bucket, and lower some things into the bucket. Lower it gingerly down to the horizon and cook something there, right? And then wheel it back up, right? You send in a chicken, you come back out with a cooked chicken, all right? And it's actually true. Now you think, but this is impossible. After all, let's say I want to prove that this is absurd. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to sit here with the chicken, right? So the Rindler observer thinks that something going on right here is incredibly hot, ridiculously hot. At that point in space-time, ridiculously hot temperatures. I say, that's totally stupid. I'm going to go with the chicken, and I'm just going to sit there. I'm sitting there with the chicken, right? I'm sitting there with the chicken. The chicken's fine. It's squawking away, right? It's absolutely fine. We're going through the horizon, me and the chicken, no problem, right? The Rindler person thinks the chicken is dying, and I am too, right? But I see the chicken, everything is fine. So I'm going to make a contradiction. I'm going to tell the Rindler guy, no, we're fine, the chicken's fine, I'm fine, everything's fine. That's when I got over here. When I got over here, I can't tell them anything. That's definitely true, okay? But no, I'm talking about over here. There, the temperature's a million degrees, as far as the Rindler person is concerned, right? Right, that's right. There, the temperature is a million degrees beyond the comfort of me and chicken, okay? Okay? But I'm going to say, no, everything's great. Trust me, everything's great. What's the problem? No, it's a... There's nothing very hot going on. There's just me, right? I'm just sitting here. I'm not seeing anything hot. Let me tell you, the story has a happy ending. The story has a happy ending. Me and the chicken will indeed survive easily. We'll go to the horizon, no problem, right? Now you have to think. The word quantum is very important here because this is entirely a quantum effect. If you put H bars in back, there is an H bar in front of this. Okay. Of course, the whole effect is quantum mechanical. So any out of this issue has to have to do with quantum mechanics. So just let's think about it. Yeah.
So I'm sending like a video message up to.
Yeah. Well, no. Let's actually do the following. Let's actually have me. Let's actually have Rindler lower the bucket. So the chicken's in the bucket. I'm not in the bucket. Okay. So, but I'm sort of following along with the chicken, right? And so Rindler is going. The Rindler observer is going to lower the chicken and then lower it back out. Lower it back up. So he doesn't need a signal to see if the chicken is cooked. He can just see if it's cooked, right? No, so I'm not going to come back out. I'm going to happily go through, right? But yeah. Yeah.
Then, from your point of view, the chicken's got to get fried, right? It has this huge acceleration.
Well, from my point of view, I'm just sitting there in Minkowski's face. I mean,
you're fine. The chicken. You're fine. You know, the chicken's going along with you because Rindler is lowering the bucket at first.
Yes, that's right. The question I was asking is, why can't I establish a contradiction by saying that I'm going to try to send Rindler a message saying the chicken is fine? The Rindler is going to raise the bucket back up, and the chicken will be fried. But then why, you know, won't Rindler be confused that Rindler got a message from me saying the chicken is fine, but the chicken is fried? The answer is that I can't send a message because of the enormous redshift that I suffer. Okay? In order for me to send a message, which can get out to Rindler at this point, I have to send an incredibly high frequency message because of quantum mechanics. So let's say Rindler is this big, it has a detector of a certain size, it wants to be able to get messages from me. I need to send an incredibly high frequency message in order for that message to be able to make it out to Rindler. Okay? But I'm next to the chicken, and that message is an enormous amount of energy and will fry the chicken just as much as so my act of doing that will fry the chicken. Okay? So really, everything is totally consistent. It is impossible to send a message out saying that everything's okay without killing a chicken. You know, I mean, I'm trying to be sensitive to the chicken. And I start sending this message, and I realize, oops, I'm actually lying, because my message will kill the chicken. So this is really true. And let me give you a little bit more intuition for why these thermal fluctuations are there to begin with. So we saw it in this sort of formal way, but there are some sometimes these virtual particle pictures are at least a little intuitively instructive. You see, so we have this picture where we say that particles are coming in and out of the vacuum all the time, right? And when we say this, we are saying it in some picture for normal Hamiltonian evolution, right? So with the normal Hamiltonian, normal notion of energies, we say in some sense the particles are flipping in and out all the time. If we look at sufficiently long scales, this is averaging out. Even though these processes are happening all the time, it's averaging out so we don't notice them. But not for the Rindler observer. You see, let's say one of these particle-antiparticles, came out here, and we're going to re-meet back up again there. This Minkowski observer, normal inertial observer, averaged over long enough times, isn't going to notice that. But the Rindler observer never sees them reconnect. The Rindler observer never sees them reconnect because the reconnection is taking place behind the Rindler horizon. So that's the intuitive source of the thermality. Again, what you're doing is taking processes that in ordinary time are taking place uniformly, but you're drastically stretching what's happening in ordinary time as you get closer and closer to the horizon. You're tremendously slowing them down and making it so that, in fact, you send the endpoint of those processes to infinity and you never see them happen. Okay. So everything that I told you, the special fact that it's thermal and the temperature is 2 pi, you need a little bit more of an argument for. But the thermality is something that is just a basic consequence of entanglement. Okay? So horizons are thermal. Horizons are thermal because the pure quantum state, because the vacuum in field theory is entangled in position between different places. This argument also tells you that close to the horizon of a black hole, there is thermal radiation. That's nothing whatsoever to do with, again, it just has to do with the fact that a Schwarzschild observer trying not to fall in is accelerating and sees this radiation in exactly the same way. Now, there is an official way, a really legal way of literally doing the trace over the degrees of freedom that you don't see to compute this density matrix. And it's very beautiful. It's a very quick argument if you know a little bit about path integrals. And it's the correct argument. So there's really a correct argument, very simple correct argument that tells you the e to the negative 2 pi. However, there is a not totally justified argument, but of a sort that always works. Well, it is justified, really, but it's really justified by the kind of computation that I'm not exactly showing you. Okay? But it's related to this basic observation. But I just want to tell it to you so you have some idea where this is coming from. Okay? It's related to the following basic observation. I'm tempted to just explain it properly. Let me just explain it properly. How many of you have any familiar with the path integral? Okay. All right. How can I do this? I can't do it in 10 minutes. I can do it in half an hour, but I can't do it in I can't do it in 10. What time is it right now?
It's 12:21.
Why don't we have lunch? Why don't we have lunch and then I'll think about how I can do it in 20 minutes. Huh? Yes. That's right.
Splitting up. So you're splitting up.